My guest is blues and jazz historian Sam Charters. He's one of the people who helped make the blues revival of the 50s and 60s possible. Some of the musicians who were at the forefront of the revival first had their work brought to the public by Charters. He's a white northerner who, as a young man, became fascinated by southern black music. During most of the 50s, he was based in Louisiana and traveled around the South making field recordings of forgotten and previously undiscovered performers. He's produced hundreds of albums of blues, Cajun, and Southern folk music, mostly for Folkways Records. In the mid to late 60s, he worked as head of artisan repertoire at Vanguard Records, where he produced the anti-war hit Fixin' to Die Rag by Country Joe and the Fish. From 1970 to 1984, Charters lived in Sweden, where he wrote his latest novel, Louisiana Black. It's about a middle-aged, middle-class black man who lives in the North and has lost touch with his Southern roots. Charters is also the author of two books about the blues. I asked Sam Charters about how he was first introduced to blues and jazz.
I'm one of those people who grew up in a family that had discovered jazz in the mid-20s. My father and my uncles had played in an amateur high school band, and in 1926 they were playing at a little lake in Michigan, playing arrangements of dance songs of the period, and someone said to them, "Well, you guys are okay, but you should hear the band at the next lake." So they went up to the next lake, and there was the Hoagy Carmichael Band playing jazz. And my family to this day has not recovered from it. And they instantly became jazz musicians. And so I just grew up with all of this. One of my aunts married a trumpet player who'd come out of Electra, Texas, with the whole Ray McKinley and that group. And so people would check in the house. Teagarden would be there hanging up on the clothes hanger because he was too drunk to stand up. And there were band rehearsals going on. And my uncles would disappear, and they would go off, and turn out they'd hitchhike to New York to see who the latest trumpet player was in the Duke Ellington band. And I assumed everybody lived this way. At the same time, they were deeply involved in Béla Bartók's music, and they were deeply involved in theater. And there was just all of this going on. My uncles, when they were trying to court a girl, would play Bessie Smith records for them, which didn't go over very well, but they certainly went over very well with me. And it wasn't until I was really in my late teens that I discovered that what I'd had as a background was really very, very unusual.
Well, you spent your life in search of music. In the 1950s, you moved from the North to the South, based yourself in Louisiana, and started making field recordings of Southern blues musicians and singers. Why did you want to go specifically to the South, and why were you interested in blues? It was jazz that you were brought up on.
That's right, and absolutely, if you were interested in jazz at that time, New Orleans was the city to go because it was still alive. So I began playing clarinet with my own jazz band when I was 13 and really wasn't very good and was looking for models. And I always was very determined if I wanted to do something, I did it. So I went to New Orleans as a teenager and looked up a man there named George Lewis. And George, for $5, would let me sit in the kitchen with him and we'd play two clarinet duets for hours. And we'd play a tune like High Society, and I'd play the melody, and George would show me 30 ways to play the chorus. And I'd read every word that you could read about jazz, and since I'd grown up with it, I thought I knew a lot. And then one day I met George on the street in the French Quarter. He was with Jim Robinson, this wonderful trombone player, George and Jim, and they were all dressed up. And I said, "Where have they been?" They'd been to a funeral. Who had died? A trumpet player. I said, "Wonderful trumpet player, Big Bammet, trumpet player from the 20s. I'd never heard of him. And I'd read every word on jazz that had ever been published. So that night when I went to see George before the job, he always rested, so he was lying in his bed resting, and I sat at the foot of the bed, and he began telling me about all the history of jazz that we'd never known anything about. And suddenly I realized that this is what I was going to try to find out about. So for the next 7 years, I lived in New Orleans, on and off traveling at the same time, interviewing all the musicians, the black musicians who'd ever played there.
Did you have specific musicians you were going in search of, maybe musicians whose records you had on 78 RPMs and who'd never been heard of for the past 30 years?
Well, the ones I was looking for hadn't even been recorded, most of them. In New Orleans, it was all legends. You knew that there was someone Louis Armstrong had learned from, and you'd heard Louis, but who was the one he learned from? Buddy Petit, and Buddy Petit had never made a record. So it became a wonderful, intense search for ghosts, looking for men who died many years before, trying to catch an echo of what their music must have been like. I tried to find every living member of the first jazz band, the Muddy Bolden Band, trying to get them to hum me their trombone parts, hum me the part that the guitar player plays, trying desperately to get to something that was lost forever. But we still had a chance to get a glint of it, get some little memories of it somehow or other.
What kind of equipment would you take with you when you were going to record somebody performing?
When I first started recording, this is marvelous, it becomes sort of like the history of early photography. People don't realize the struggles we had. The early machines in the late 40s, which I couldn't afford, were simply wind-ups. We had a heavy flywheel and always ran down. And then you could possibly get a new thing called a wire recorder, but they got all tangled up and had very low fidelity. And then you could get tape recorders, which was brand new. So I bought my first tape recorder in 1953, one of the very first cheap models. Had a little green eye that blinked at me, and the eye closed when I played two things too loudly on it. And it must have weighed, sometimes I thought it weighed several hundred pounds, but I carried the damn thing for 5 or 6 years, and I did 35, 40 records with it. I had a microphone that I stuck with me, and I hitchhiked around with that damn thing. And it wasn't until finally I went to Africa in 74 that I was able to take a really good battery-operated stereo tape recorder with me.
Well, you were traveling around the rural South. Did you always have electricity to plug the tape machine into?
In 1954, I'd heard of a group called the Mobile Strugglers, which was one of the last real, genuine skiffle bands in the South, playing with washboards and washtub bass and everything. So I went over, and I was very inexperienced, but I had my tape recorder, and I managed to get the washtub bass player out of jail where he'd gone from drunk and disorderly, and managed to track the guys down. We were in a little shack neighborhood outside of Mobile, back in the sort of the woods, and I was looking for some place to plug in my tape recorder because I had to plug it in. And the fellow said, "Well, there's a house right there. I know those people. We'll go in there." So we went in, and of course plugged in and everything. And I used the people's ironing board for the microphone stand. Of course, they didn't know anybody lived there. We'd simply broken into somebody's house. And the people came in later in that afternoon, and here was this recording session going on with the tape recorder. And by that point, we'd managed to find some beer. I was incredibly embarrassed, but they were very, very kind about it. They understood, danced along with the playbacks. We had a great afternoon.
What kind of leads did you pick up on to find the musicians who you were interested in? How would you find out where they were? Well, you had to be like a detective.
I felt sometimes more like someone, an insurance tracer or a skip claim tracer. I felt I was doing something like that. You try to find somebody who'd last been seen in a little town outside of New Orleans in 1924, and you could usually find them. You had to be patient.
You've also discovered musicians who no one, aside from local people, knew about before.
Oh, yeah.
One of them was Lightnin' Hopkins.
That's right.
Who's very familiar, I think, to people who listen to blues now. How did you first hear about him?
Well, it was impossible to not hear the blues as a jazz musician, even though we tried to keep the two separate. As early as the late 40s, the jazz groups I was playing with, we had one or two blues records that we would listen to, even though we knew nothing about it, nothing. And I heard over the radio. I was part of the black community in the early 50s, and the radios were on, and I'd hear Lightnin' Hopkins, who was a figure somewhere out of Texas, who was making some records for a funny little record company called Gold Star, which then went out of business. Lightnin' disappeared. But I always ate in a same sort of rundown restaurant in the French Quarter. And it turned out I was talking one day about Lightnin' Hopkins, and the cook said, "That's my cousin." And he at least directed me to Houston. And then once I got in the Houston ghetto, after about 3 days of asking around, found a sister who didn't know anything, found a place where his guitar was in pawn. They didn't know anything. And finally, I was sitting in my car at a street corner, and a car pulled up beside me, and a man rolled down the window and said, "You looking for me?" And I said, "You Lightnin'?" And he said, "That's right." So I rented a guitar for him, got a bottle of gin. We went back to the little shabby room where he was living, and we made his first LP.
What was it like?
It was marvelous. I'd never heard anything quite like it in my life. Lightnin' went on and did hundreds of records, some of them losing the intensity, but for me, this was the first time he'd had a chance to stretch out without time limits, to simply do a range of songs. So he wasn't having to worry about starting on time, stopping on time. I was sitting there with the microphone right in front of him, so he could simply be free. And he'd always been working with an electrical guitar, and I rented him an acoustic. So he was playing with music he was hearing himself in a marvelous way. And for me, I come closer, I think, to the genesis of the blues. than I'd ever come before, because Lightning was such an extraordinary artist.
Now, how old was he at this time?
Lightning would have been in his, I think, been 49. I think born 1910, I believe.
Now, we have a recording standing by of Lightning Hopkins. Yeah. Is this from that first session?
That's right.
That
this
recorded?
Is from the first song he did, the Penitentiary Blues, where he took the old work song about Ain't No More Cain in This Brazos and turned it into a blues.
Why don't we hear it?
Yep.
Penitentiary Blues. Big Brad is here come. Oh, Lord, have mercy. Big Brad is here come. You know I'm gonna do time for another man. When it haven't been a thing poor Lightning done. They say you ought to been on Brad 19 and 10. Buddy Russell drove pretty women just like he did ugly miss. I'm Big Brad. Yes, here I come. Finna do time for another man. And ain't nothing poor Lightning done. Well, you ought to be ashamed. My mama called me. I answered, ma'am. She saw you tired of working. I said, mama, yes, I am. Papa called me. I answered, sir. He said, son, if you're tired of working, when the hell you gonna stay there? I couldn't. No, I just couldn't help myself. You know a man can't help but feel bad when he's doing time for someone there. You better watch it all the time.
Lightning Hopkins recorded in 1959. I guess when you were recording the session with Lightning Hopkins that you weren't disappointed.
I couldn't believe it. Absolutely couldn't believe it because I had... In all these years, been looking for the beginnings, been looking for the roots, which meant I was always working with older musicians. And quite often, even when they were playing for me, I was only getting a memory of what they had played like when they were young. And this was the first time I'd met someone really just at the height of his creative powers, that someone who had the imagination, had the flow and the vitality.
Did this record change his life?
It absolutely did. He was completely flabbergasted by the whole thing. Here was this person just showing up, handing him a guitar, giving him $200 and disappearing. And appeared on a number of best record lists. It got rave reviews. In fact, whole spectrum, jazz, folklorists, everybody loved it. And all of a sudden, there were four more LPs by the end of the year, and his career started. We'd meet over the years. We'd encounter each other at clubs. And it's always a very good relationship. We did a lot of records together after that.
You were living in the black community in Louisiana and traveling in black circles in the South.
Right.
This was the 1950s. The South was still segregated. Were you, you must have really stuck out a lot, one of the few people probably in black circles at that time and one of the few white people in black circles in the South at that time.
It was always complicated because... racism was an official policy of these small communities. It wasn't that simply people were prejudiced. It was simply the law I was arrested a lot. I was picked up a lot. And I was scared a lot. Every person I talked to was immediately questioned by the local sheriff, the deputies afterwards. I remember I was looking for Robert Johnson in Mississippi, and I talked to a couple of people on a street in just one of the little towns there, Friars Point. And I got down to the end of the corner, and I was looking at my map, and I looked back, and a deputy had both the persons I'd talked to up against a tree. And all I simply asked them for was directions. But I was not a car they recognized, and I was white. Only wanted that. So I always had to be very careful, not only for my own sake, but for the sake of the people I talked with. In New Orleans, it was quite literally illegal for me to shake hands with a black musician on the street. And the streetcars were still with those damn signs you moved up and down saying white, black, you know, segregated, and you had to move them up and down. And if you tried to do anything against it, you simply got people in trouble. And so when I'd go with the musicians into a bar, they'd always have to, into a black bar, they'd always have to pass me off as a full-blooded Indian. They may look white, but he's a full-blooded Indian.
Well, that comment that you just made reminds me, too, that I wonder if you've ever felt at times like you were in an awkward position with a black musician you were recording, because especially in the 1950s when you were finding people who were really down on their luck a lot, who were poor, who hadn't, no one knew who they were, no one knew about their talents. They'd been in and out of prison, maybe. So you're coming from a more, you know, advantaged, privileged background. You have the money to give them and so on. It's not exactly a position of equality. And when you have this political sense that you're that's motivating your work, mm-hmm. you can really feel the unevenness of a relationship like that. How would you deal with that?
Well, there was no way to deal with it, because there was no way that they could understand enough of me or my background to in any way comprehend the complex nature of this. And also, they were very religious, most of them, and deeply conservative politically, and that here was someone who was essentially irreligious and rather radical, coming down and doing this for his own reasons. So they simply regarded me as a white recording boss. And the only possible relationship most of the time was that. And of course, I was endlessly trying to make it friendship, but it couldn't be. You know, it would have been some of them wonderful ones like Big Joe Williams and things, they totally understood that they totally didn't understand. And they just accepted it all as some crazy cloud cuckoo land.
But it must be tough for you to have this identity as the boss man to someone whose music you really admire, you know, because you don't see yourself as the boss.
No, and yet the only way I could make the thing happen, because because to get better recording sound, finally, I was using small recording studios and everything. And the musicians themselves had been waiting for a break or waiting to be rediscovered. They were very much part of the musical world. To us, they were quaint folk musicians, too. It's many the way many people regarded them. But for as far as they were concerned, they were pop stars or had been pop stars, and they wanted to be on the radio again. And what I did in the first book, The Country Blues, was I really exaggerated the romance of the search for these guys. So the book is incredible passages of purple prose about drifting around little towns in Texas, because I recognized that at that point I was the only one doing this. I had the whole South, so I simply needed help. So I didn't say I need help. I simply wrote the most romantic book I could think of about being a young white blues researcher driving around the South. So the book came out, and I went to Europe for a year, and I came back. And there were people in every small town in the South, young, white college kids, and they found everybody. It was one of the great research projects. In 4 or 5 years, they found every living blues musician. Unbelievable.
My guest is blues and jazz record producer and historian Sam Charters. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Sam Charters is my guest. He's a record producer, music historian, and novelist. His new novel is titled Louisiana Black. Your days in the South doing a lot of field recording coincided toward the end of your stay with the beginnings of the Civil Rights Movement and the Freedom Rides. Yeah. How did that affect you? Did it make it any easier or harder for you
much
to
harder.
Do your
it got
work?
Much more dangerous. And at this point, you were dealing not only with local sheriffs and things, but the National Guards and with the all of their communication system. I remember one point with my wife, we'd taken a few pictures in the black ghetto in Birmingham, and the first white person that went past us in a car. A car was stopped and went right to the corner of the phone booth. We saw them phone, made a telephone call. And before we even could really get the cameras back and get in the car, there were two army vehicles, you know, just boxing in our car. And they just took us right to the edge of Birmingham.
Well, how did you spend the 1960s?
I was doing an awful lot of writing. And more and more, after the Country Blues, I became very much in demand by record companies who wanted me to go south. I came back from my time in Europe. I'd been writing a novel in Edinburgh and came back. And I'd been back 2 days. I came back with $13. And 2 days later, I had immediately assignments to go to the south and start recording blues people again. So I had to find everybody that I'd found in the research for the book and make records with them. And then in 1964, Vanguard was involved in recording the Newport Folk Festival. And 1964, we gathered together every one of these blues musicians. And it was like heaven's going to be. There they all were in one house together, some of them meeting each other for the first time, going back to the world of the blues. There was Robert Pete Williams and Skip James and Sleepy John Estes and Robert Pete Williams and Reverend Wilkins. It was just incredible, just incredible. And then so Vanguard then asked me if I wanted to go to Chicago to record there. I said, well, they said, what should I do? And I said, go to Chicago. So they sent me there, and I did a three-volume series called Chicago the Blues Today, which was the breakthrough for this audience for much of the Chicago blues. And then I went off from that after writing a couple of books. I went around the world and came back and stopped in San Francisco to see my friends just as the San Francisco scene was breaking, the whole psychedelic circus going on. So I went to New York and stopped by Vanguard, planning to just write another book. And Vanguard said, is anything going on? I said, San Francisco. So they sent me back out to San Francisco.
What a life.
I've heard an awful lot of good music.
Have people who've read your books, especially your new book, or heard your records, assumed that you were black?
Most do. And this has been difficult. It's been such a difficult point that for part of the 70s, I decided I would do no more work in the field of black music. So I didn't do anything from 70 until 73, expecting that a young black scholar would step in and do this kind of historical work. But because of the sensitivity involved, none did. So back I went and started again. And there were a series of books in the 70s, again, documenting the blues, documenting black music. But no, I had always felt this kind of sensitivity. But the only thing that really put it in perspective for me was after my first blues book came out, The Country Blues, I was at a party with the Folkways office, and there was Langston Hughes. And Langston was telling me how much he liked the book. And I said, Langston, thank you, but you could tell me so much more about the blues than I'll ever know. And Langston looked at me and said, tell me something about Schubert that I don't know. And I realized at that point that this is simply something to learn about, and that it didn't matter what color or what your background was. If you set out to learn it and you were open, you could learn. And so this has been my final justification for continuing to absorb myself in it. Absolutely, there may be nuances I miss, but after all these years, there are a lot of nuances that I get, and I'll settle for that.
Let's talk about your new novel. Let me preface this by saying that it's about an American northern black man, middle class man who works. Is he an accountant?
Yeah, he's an accountant for a small firm in Bridgeport.
And through finding a photograph of someone who he thinks is his father, mm-hmm. It's a photograph of him being lynched.
Yeah.
He decides to leave for a while and go in search. Go to the South to search out who his father was, why he was lynched, and in doing so, he learns a lot about himself. It's written from the perspective of this black northern man, and it's interesting that you, as a white person who's lived so much within black communities, chose to write it from a black perspective.
I didn't in any way think of the anomaly that involved until the book was virtually done, and then I really became quite uncomfortable because I was in some way presenting myself as a spokesman for black consciousness, because it is an issue that I'm addressing, a black issue. And but I had spent so much of my life being involved in the black community, and particularly in the 70s when I was in Sweden, I became very involved in recording in western Louisiana, working with a black group called Rockin' Doopsie and his Cajun Twisters. And I would literally be there months at a time, just living with Dupsy and his family, staying in a local motel. And my whole orientation toward the United States in those years became simply through the black community. And so that when I came to write the book, I didn't even have any doubts when I began. Then I must say when I finished, I thought this was very presumptuous that I'd done this. And looking back on it, I am uncomfortable about it in a way, but I accept the fact that this is what I was driven to write.
What are your ethnic roots or, you know, what are your roots? What would you be searching out if you did a very personal search?
Oh, I already did that. I'm from Scotland.
Did you really do that?
Yeah. My family's from Hoyk in Roxburghshire. And the different branches came at different times, but the essential charter, I'm Samuel Barclay Charters, the fourth, the original Samuel Charters was the Bishop of Hoyk and wrote a history of local witchcraft and four or five studies on bashfulness and shyness at the 1790s and 1810s. And the family became actually very prosperous, very active in Pittsburgh in the 1870s, had chains of grocery stores and sold everything to, that's how they could afford to be gentlemen jazz enthusiasts. They all were in prep school together, and that was the difference.
I'm sure you have no second thoughts about how you've spent your life musically and in your writing.
It's difficult in the United States as a writer because there is, as you know, a very aggressive anti-intellectualism. And if you attempt to have writing that's political or specific, you're in trouble. But I must say there was so much exhilaration in the work I was doing that even though I couldn't concentrate on the creative prose that I wanted to, I still felt that there was enough to do.
My guest has been blues and jazz historian and record producer Sam Charters. His latest book is a novel titled Louisiana Black, published by Marion Boyers. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with syndicated columnist Joyce Maynard, whose new book is titled Domestic Affairs, Enduring the Pleasures of Motherhood and Family Life. So I hope you can join us. Let's listen to some music from the debut recording of Zydeco accordionist Rockin' Dupsy. This was produced by Sam Charters in 1976.